This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Want to try a sound experiment now? For the next few seconds, just sit perfectly still and listen carefully, not to this program, but the sound around you. Okay, what you just did is what scientists do when they study acoustics. They listen, they measure the quality of sound in a room. Acoustics has long been associated with architecture and technology. A new book titled The Soundscape of Modernity explores that history. Emily Thompson wrote the book, and she says that the way we hear and the way we listen depends a great deal on one particular period in the past, 1899 to 1933. Alex Van Oss reports.
In 1899, the city of Boston wanted to build a new symphony hall. Music and formal concerts had become serious business in America, and Boston wanted the new venue to be a perfect temple for music, a place where audiences could hear every note. To make sure there'd be no strange echoes or dead spots in Symphony Hall, historian Emily Thompson says the builders hired a Harvard science teacher to work out the acoustics. His name was Wallace Sabine.
If you happen to be on the Harvard University campus at around 3 a.m. around the turn of the century, you might have seen a young physicist carrying stacks of seat cushions across the campus, taking them into rooms so that he could make his measurements.
Sabine worked in the dead of night, when all was still and quiet. What he was doing was carrying into those rooms different numbers of cushions, and then he'd make a big noise. Sabine would send compressed air through an organ pipe and then measure the reverberation in the room with or without cushions. He did this for years and eventually came up with a mathematical formula, XY equals K, which became a foundation of the science of acoustics. Now, what that formula means, basically, is the following.
Without cushions or rugs or curtains, a room can sound like this.
But on the other hand, with too much insulation in the room, you might as well have your head in a shoebox. The sound is dull.
To cut down on the echoes at Boston Symphony Hall, Wallace Sabine told the architect to reduce the building's volume. He also recommended adding an extra row of balcony seats. When the hall opened in 1900, some people liked the acoustics, others didn't, but everyone finally got used to the sound. Media historian Jonathan Stern says that while acoustics is an objective science, it still relies on listeners' subjective response.
Hearing is, in fact, listening more accurately, is one of the most cultured things that human beings do. So, for instance, what sounds clean and appealing to you and me may sound just completely unpleasant to someone else.
Or maybe just confusing. In Emily Thompson's new book, The Soundscape of Modernity, she traces the history of how the public got used to new experiences in sound. Back in the early 1900s, Thomas Edison invented wax and later diamond disc recordings. To promote his new technology, Edison hired opera singers to go on tour. At Carnegie Hall and other concert venues, he'd turn out the lights and invite the audience to guess what they were listening to. Was it the singer or the disc? Supposedly, audiences in those days couldn't tell the difference. Emily Thompson.
We might take that claim with a grain of salt, particularly because some of these artists have confessed that when they sang live, they actually controlled their voice to make it sound like the recording, to make the comparison harder to distinguish.
As the 20th century progressed, the public had to get used to more and more sounds of technology. Electricity meant that there was a lot more noise than ever before. As early as 1906, acoustics and noise abatement became a celebrated cause when some upstanding New Yorkers tried to crack down on public hubbub. They tried to put street merchants and Coney Island barkers out of business, and they formed a society for the suppression of unwanted noise.
Many wealthy and engaged women, like Mrs. Isaac Rice or in Philadelphia, Imogene Oakley, undertook this as a kind of personal mission to attempt to quiet the din of the modern city. They were concerned about its effect on people's health. They worked to establish quiet zones around hospitals and schools. Ultimately, their efforts were not very successful, and the solution to the problem of noise became one that was architectural rather than social. Simply build a soundproof retreat and escape from the noise.
Getting away from noise became so desirable that very soon businesses started to cash in. Jonathan Stern.
By the 1920s, you have acoustic firms saying that what we do, what we sell, is the sonic part of architecture, that sound is a commodity just like anything else. Good sound is an especially valuable commodity, and that's something that we manufacture for our clients.
During the 1920s, noise insulation grew as an industry. One could order sound-absorbent tiles or building products with names like Sanacoustic and Silent Seal.
These materials are made of seemingly anything and everything. Gypsum, mineral wool, volcanic silica, flax, sugarcane fibers, disinfected cattle hair, all of which were dedicated to the absorption of sound. Indeed, control through absorption was the motto of one of these manufacturers and how they characterized what their products offered.
And it worked. These new materials kept the outdoors out and the indoors quiet. So intensely quiet, in fact, that in some cases, sound had to be reinforced and pumped back in. When Radio City Music Hall opened in 1932, New York audiences found themselves in a state-of-the-art space for watching concerts, movies, dance routines, and Christmas spectaculars. What audiences didn't know was that Radio City Music Hall should have had terrible acoustics, but thanks to technology, it did not.
The vast auditorium, although the expanding arches that define its proscenium were compared to expanding waves of sound. In fact, those arches were constructed of tons of sound-absorbing plaster. The proscenium arches have golden grills within them, and behind some of those grills were loudspeakers. And what the audience at Radio City Music Hall actually heard was the broadcast from the loudspeakers being beamed down onto them as if they were listening to the radio at home.
Thompson says that Radio City Music Hall ushered in a new age of acoustic design. In the old days, space controlled the sound, but now sound could manipulate the space as an electronic signal, clean and clear. This became what Emily Thompson calls the modern sound.
The modern sound was also fundamentally the product of modern technology. It wasn't natural. It was new. It was engineered. It was an efficient sound. It was a sound that was a commodity that you could purchase and consume.
Jonathan Stern.
I would go further than just clean and clear. I would say that the modern sound is the sound that you're supposed to pay attention to as sound, qua sound, if you will.
100 years ago, acoustics was a function of cushions and curtains and room size. But nowadays, you can have controlled sound piped into every nook and cranny and listen to music direct from CD to eardrum. Still, says Thompson, what we expect and demand from 21st century technology, that thirst was awakened 100 years ago. And it was part of a larger cultural wave, she says, one in which modern societies began to disconnect time and space and become, in a sense, dislocated.
Reverberation is experiencing space through time. How long does the echo last in a space tells us something about that architectural space. Or it did. It no longer does. It's not unlike Cubist art, the stream of consciousness prose of James Joyce, Einstein's physics. All of these are cultural phenomena that historians have argued manifest modernity by this ability to reconfigure the relationship between time and space. I think these acoustical technologies are another important example of this larger phenomenon.
Emily Thompson is the author of the recently published The Soundscape of Modernity. Jonathan Stern's book, The Audible Past, The Cultural Origins of Sound Reproduction, will be published in October. For NPR News, this is Alex Van Oss in Washington.